Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the net effect of immigration on the United States? Some who welcome newcomers from abroad extol the cultural and economic benefits of a diverse population, while some who wish for more restrictions on immigration worry that since many newly arrived U.S. residents are poorer than their American-born neighbors, they might use more than their fair share of resources. A conference taking place later this week at SMU will examine some of the effects of migration on life in America, and my guest joins us to talk about them. Robert Lawson holds the Jerome M. Fullenwider Endowed Centennial Chair in Economic Freedom at the O'Neill Center for Global Markets and Freedom. On Friday, September 26th, the center will sponsor a conference on the SMU campus where they're located called The Road to Freedom, Migration and the Search for a Better Life. Bob, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So one of the subjects that you've written pretty extensively about is the impact that immigration has on economic freedom. What is economic freedom and what drives it?
Sure. Well, I've been studying economic freedom for all of my career. I do something called an Economic Freedom of the World Index, and it rates countries on how economically free they are. And what we mean by that is pretty much what most normal people call capitalism. So when you think of capitalism, you think of relatively low taxes, a relatively small government, relatively limited government control of business, free trade, private property. And so we have measures for all of these things, dozens of measures actually for hundreds of countries. And we put a number on it. So you know, Hong Kong is the highest rated country in the world. It's the most economically free. I think Venezuela is the last country. It's the lowest rated country. I might note we don't rate North Korea, so they would undoubtedly be last.
They put themselves at number one anyway, probably.
No doubt. So that's what we mean by economic freedom. It's what most people call laissez-faire capitalism or free markets or something like that. And it's a quantitative and scientific really measurement of that concept.
So where does the U.S. fall?
Well, the U.S. falls, well, we've been dropping actually. So for most of the term of the study, which goes back to the 1970s, it was the United States was always third. It was Hong Kong, Singapore, and then the United States. But in the last decade or so, about the last 12 years of data that we have, and it started with George W. Bush becoming president, I might add, the U.S. rating began to fall. And we're now down to 17th in the most recent report, and we're releasing a report next week, which I'm not allowed to talk about, but it'll be a little bit better. But basically, we're in the middle teens now.
Is that because of regulation?
You know, it's a lot of factors. It is since 2000, we've seen Washington's on a bit of a spending binge. They're on a bit of a regulation binge. You know, Sarbanes-Oxley, you know, Dodd-Frank, and in the financial industries, you could add Obamacare to that as increased regulation of business. But actually, the biggest thing in our numbers has been the property rights and rule of law measures, which is a little bit of a surprise. But we have data from a number of different sources, and they're all pointing in the direction, same direction, which is for worse rule of law in the United States, less impartiality in the courts, more favoritism in terms of how government treats people. So it's not just the spending and regulations. It's sort of the more core, almost the core issue of private property and rule of law that's the U.S. has been falling down on.
So when you talk about more favoritism and how the courts treat people, are you talking about people or corporations people? Or what are you referring to?
Well, at least in our context, we don't really distinguish between that. But I mean, a good example for the United States would be the Kelo decision, which was in the sort of middle of this period that I'm talking about, the middle of the 2000s. Where the Supreme Court gave its sort of thumbprint of approval on the practice of local governments taking one person's property to essentially give it to another person's person. Now, you know, in a market economy, the way that's supposed to work is if you want someone else's property is you knock on their door and you make them an offer, you know. And if they say no, you make them another offer. And if they keep saying no, well, then I'm sorry for you. You don't get the property. That's how markets work. But now, of course, if you want a piece of person's property, it might be easier to go to city council. However that works, and convince city council to eminent domain the person's property that you want. And that's an increasing practice. The Supreme Court's actually given its, as I mentioned, they've approved this practice. But to me, that's a type of favoritism where the government is just saying, hey, look, this person is more important and they deserve your property more than you do. You're the owner of it, though. So that's the kind of favoritism I think that is in people's minds in those data.
So you and your colleagues found a small but positive gain for the incomes of native-born Americans that can be attributed to the presence of immigrants. First of all, how do new immigrants make it possible for native-born Americans to make better money, do better financially?
Yeah, the big evidence from all the papers, almost all the papers that have been written by academics, show that there are net gains to Americans from immigrants. And the mechanism is primarily through specialization. I mean, I actually still mow my own lawn. But I'm a relatively well-paid SMU professor. And to a certain extent, it's kind of inefficient for me to spend a couple hours of my week mowing my own lawn. If we had more immigrants, I might be able to hire someone to mow my lawn. And so one way in which immigrants help native-born Americans is they free up time that we could spend doing more valuable things, but instead we're mowing our own lawns or cleaning our own kitchens and things like that. So to a certain extent, poorer immigrants who provide those kinds of services to Americans actually make us richer by freeing up our time and resources for other things that are even more valuable.
There is a slight negative impact for native-born Americans who are at the lowest end of the economic rung, maybe have the fewest skills, marketable skills.
Yeah, indeed. The net gain is positive, but there are certain segments of the American population, American workforce, who probably lose. And it's mostly going to be at the lower end of the income distribution. Low-income Americans, low-skilled Americans, they're in direct competition with immigrants for those, lawn mowing jobs and things of that sort. So there's a negative effect there. Although I must say the effect is vanishingly small. I mean, the last number I saw, it was something along the lines of 0.1% lower income for low-income Americans over a 20-year period. I mean, to be kind of blunt about it, that's like a cup of coffee a day. I mean, it is a reduction in income for low-income Americans, but it's a really tiny one in comparison to the gains to other Americans. And we should also count the immigrants. I mean, the immigrants themselves get massive gains. I mean, the mere act of moving from Mexico to the United States or from Haiti to the United States, that mere act makes that Haitian, 8, 10, 20 times better off. So there's a little bit of pain for some Americans. There's a little bit of gain for most Americans. And there's a lot of benefit for the immigrants themselves. And, my worldview, we're all human beings. Everybody should count in this calculus.
For studies like this, do you make a distinction between immigrants who come in and do, pardon the expression, the jobs that Americans don't want to do, and those who come in on, H-1B visas and are doing pretty highly paid, highly skilled labor?
Our work doesn't do that. I mean, there are papers out there that look exclusively at the H-1B type immigrant versus the lower skilled immigrants and so on. Our work doesn't really look at that. And most of the work that's done of the sort we were just talking about, where you calculate net benefits, sort of lumps all immigrants together. It's sort of the net effect, when you slice and dice all types of immigrants. To a certain extent, it'd be true what I said about if we let more economics professors into the United States, that would probably harm my income because mm-hmm. that's more competition for the kinds of things that I do. So I'm in favor of competition, generally speaking, but the distributional effects would vary depending on what kind of immigrant you're talking about.
So one of the things you found was that immigrants, no matter where they're going in the world and no matter where they're coming from, tend to move from countries with fewer social services and benefits to those with more. Surely there are exceptions to that, but that tends to be the pattern. Is that right?
Well, not necessarily. What we find is that people are attracted to economic opportunity. And countries that have a lot of economic opportunity, rich countries, let's mm-hmm. call them, they also tend to provide social services. But I think it's what we find in our analysis is it's not so much the social services that are attracting them as much as the incomes, the jobs. So you have to sort of disentangle the attraction. Is the attraction what one immigration scholar calls it? Is it a welfare magnet, or is it an economic growth or an income magnet? I think the evidence is more on that side. They're more interested in job opportunities and incomes than they are, going on some kind of on the dole, if you want to use that term.
And even if there were a welfare magnet, the rising percentages of immigrants causes that outlay to shrink.
Yeah, indeed. That's the big debate that's going on right now in the academic literature is, well, how are immigrants going to affect the policies of the country that's taking them in? it's a little bit political to say it this way, but you know, the narrative from some folks would be, well, they're going to import their socialism with them. You know, mm-hmm. here we are in Texas, and we had a lot of capitalist loving people, and they're worried about immigrants. They think they're going to, they're coming from Venezuela. Kind of Venezuela is, the People's Republic of Venezuela now, pretty much. And so, are they going to bring their crazy bad ideas with them? Well, what we find is, and I think this should not be surprising, we find the exact opposite. In fact, countries that absorb the most immigrants, their policies get more free market. They get more capitalist, which isn't too surprising. I mean, after all, they voted with their feet. Mm-hmm. They left Venezuela. They left these places. And presumably, they weren't looking for another Venezuela to go to. So to me, it's not a surprising result, but it's the result we find. And I think it's comforting. For people who are worried about immigrants dramatically changing the sort of the American way, mom, apple pie, and Chevrolet, if you're really worried about that, we're not really finding a lot of evidence that's taking place around the world.
How politically active are immigrants compared with their native-born neighbors?
Well, I think – I actually don't know the direct answer to that. Anecdotally, I think they're pretty much not active. I mean, illegal immigrants, of course, undocumented immigrants, whatever you want to call them, are, of course, not very politically active. They do everything they can to stay below the radar. But – most of the mechanism that scholars look at here is the reaction of the natives. Mm-hmm. Is how are the natives going to react to this influx of immigrants? Ironically, the American anti-immigrant political crowd is primarily identified with the right, sort of the Tea Party Republicans and things of that sort. Ironically, in Europe, it's more the left. There's quite a bit of concern among the progressive left, the socialists, the social democrats of Europe. They worry that a lot of immigrants coming into, let's say, Sweden will reduce the Swedish willingness to vote for the welfare state. And so it's kind of weird if you read the anti-immigrant rhetoric, political rhetoric in Europe. It's a left-wing worry that they're gonna ruin our socialism. But in America, it's like they're going to bring socialism with them. And well, maybe America and Europe have different problems, and maybe immigrants to Europe are different than immigrants to the United States. But at least at the surface, it's an odd sort of disconnect between how immigrants are perceived politically in Europe and versus the United States.
Is some of that difference attributable to the fact that the United States, although we have struggled over the years, we are a nation of immigrants and we are a pretty ethnically diverse population?
Oh, there's no question about it. I mean, part of that mom, apple pie, and Chevrolet, concept is the nation of immigrants and the melting pot and so on. I think we're seeing it. But, we exaggerate that. I mean, anti-immigrant sentiment goes back to the know-nothings of the 1840s. I mean, we've had waves of anti-immigrant sentiment, and it tends to happen when times are tough, as people sort of look for, I don't know, necessarily a scapegoat, but people look for someone to blame, and it's sometimes easy to blame the other, the people that don't look like us or speak like us. But, the United States is a nation of immigrants, but this is not a new debate to this country. And it's not a new debate even to European countries that I mentioned.
And, of course, when times are tough, immigration rates tend to fall off a little bit.
Indeed. Of course, we've actually seen, I think, net reversals in case of Mexican immigration. It sort of goes to the sort of, is it a welfare magnet or an income magnet? I mean, if it was an income magnet, when times are tough, you might expect to see more immigrants coming to the country because times are tough. Need to go on welfare. In fact, the reversal of immigration trends during recessions, like we've seen in the last few years, seems to, again, support the notion that they're really attracted to jobs and economic opportunity. And when that goes away, well, might as well go home. There's that's sort of anecdotal evidence, but I think it's consistent with the larger scholarly literature that we have.
We're speaking this hour with Robert Lawson, who holds the Jerome M. Fullenweider Endowed Centennial Chair in Economic Freedom at SMU's O'Neill Center for Global Markets and Freedom. On Friday, September 26th, the center will sponsor a conference called The Road to Freedom, Migration and the Search for a Better Life. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us now at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Robert Lawson, who holds the Jerome M. Fullenweider Endowed Centennial Chair in Economic Freedom at the O'Neill Center for Global Markets and Freedom at SMU. Friday, the center will sponsor a conference called The Road to Freedom, Migration and the Search for a Better Life. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. How do large immigrant populations tend to impact the perception among native-born Americans that their jobs are in jeopardy? And does that perception track with reality?
Well, I don't think it tracks with reality. I mean, immigrants both take jobs and they also create jobs. So, I mean, in economics terms, they're both suppliers and demanders. So people tend to see them as in their competition in labor markets. So you lose out a job and then you see an immigrant in that job, well, they took my job. Right. What is a little bit more invisible and harder to see, but just as real, is when the immigrant takes that paycheck and goes down to the mall and buys something. And that creates a job for somebody else. Now, that connection, though, from the immigrant spending their money and creating a job, you know, 10 states away for whatever product they purchased, that's a much more indirect and invisible kind of benefit that immigrants bring. So it's one of the classic what economists call the seen and the unseen problem. We see in a very direct way, the sort of cost of immigrants, and they take jobs from other Americans, but we don't see as directly the benefits when they spend those paychecks. When you net it all out, and it's not terribly surprising from a matter of economic theory, but when you net it all out, it turns out it's close to a wash, and because of some of the things we mentioned earlier about specialization, it's probably a benefit to the typical American.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone now to Roxanne in North Richland Hills. Hi, Roxanne.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
My question is, have you considered or what effect does the fact that many immigrants, whether they are here legally or illegally, send most of their money to their home country, to their families in their homes. They come here, they work hard, they will live several in an apartment and or a home, and then send the bulk of their money back to their family in their original country.
It's a great question. In some ways, this is no different than an import then. So when Americans buy imports, we get the product we get a car from Japan and we send the money to Japan. So when an immigrant comes to the United States, we get the service that they provide and if they repatriate it back to their country, the money seems to go away. And just like with imports, my view is that when immigrants send money abroad, eventually, and it may not be the next day, but eventually that money rebounds to the United States because what we've done is they've provided U.S. foreign exchange. This gets a little technical, but it provides U.S. foreign exchange to the rest of the world. And the only place U.S. dollars are really valuable is, well, in the United States. And so eventually those dollars come back to the United States. Again, it's unseen. It's indirect. It's distant because the immigrant sends his dollars back to his village and they use those dollars to buy bread, maybe from imported grain from the United States. So the fact that immigrant benefited that grain farmer, a month later is not something that's easy to see and for most people.
Do significant enough levels of remittances actually hold down immigration from the whatever the country of origin is?
Actually, I've never done any work on this, but I kind of want to is look at what I think could be some negative consequences of repatriated money to the receiving country. Hmm. I've done a little bit of work in the South Caucasus and Armenia. Of course, Armenia has had a huge diaspora with, literally hundreds of thousands of Armenians have moved, left. There's more Armenians living outside of Armenia than I think in Armenia itself now. And many of them, of course, have been very successful. Armenian businessmen in the United States, families, California, they send lots of money back. And unfortunately, in some ways, it almost ruins the Armenian economy because these massive checks sort of come in from their uncles in Fresno, California. And the people in Armenia don't really feel – their economic opportunities there aren't very good.
So there's no pressure to innovate because money's coming.
There's no pressure for them to really be entrepreneurial, you know, and try to expand their own local opportunities because, well, the money's coming in. It's kind of like a welfare trap. It's not a welfare trap that government's created. It's a privately created, but it's the same kind of welfare trap that I think some people identify with welfare in the United States and other Western European countries is kind of hitting these villages back home. I don't want to say shouldn't send your money home, but there is I think a potentially sort of welfare trap effect associated with it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next on the phone to Scott in Dallas. Hi, Scott.
Yeah, I was wondering in your Economic Freedom Index how you treat utilities. Of course, the first road to serfdom was done from privatized utilities. In the Magna Carta, we ended that. We regulated them, and the economy's prospered ever since. We have a 50-year deal where we're saying we need to treat those as if they're free, which they certainly aren't. There's no competition or alternatives. How do y'all rate those? Would you reward a country for deregulating their utilities?
The short answer is yes, we would. We have one measure in the index that directly measures state-owned enterprises, which would include state-owned electricity and companies of that sort. We also have some measures related to government regulation that would basically protect private monopolies. So, deregulation and a more open and competitive utility market would be a positive in our index. It's not I would say weighting-wise, it's not dramatically large. In comparison to, say, government spending, which is a big part of the index, this is a relatively small part of the index. But, yeah, we would give credit for privatizing and deregulating utilities.
How do you define institutional quality, and what does that have to do with the way we live economically in this country?
Yeah, institutional quality is a word economists and development economists throw around.
It's a wonky term.
It's also very loose, and it's I don't know what it is, but I know it when I see it kind of thing. In the work that I do, not surprisingly, since I produce this Economic Freedom of the World Index, I tend to sort of identify institutional quality with better economic freedom. But there are a number of measures that are out there that get used. There's a group called Polity, P-O-L-I-T-Y. It's sort of a measure of authoritarian versus non-authoritarian democratic regime. There's a competitiveness index out there, and it's a little bit different than a freedom index. So institutional quality gets defined a little bit differently. But almost all of the people that use the term are kind of basically saying the same thing, basically an open society. A society where you have some sense of rule of law. It doesn't mean you have, Hong Kong-like tax rates necessarily. You could still have, relatively high taxes. But you got to sort of be open, entrepreneurial, have rule of law, have basic private property and stability. And that's what I think most people mean. You're going to get arguments when you get into the details with different people. But I put a little bit more emphasis on freedom. Other scholars might put a little bit more emphasis on democracy or political type regime, and still others might say, "Hey, no, it's really about national competitiveness," which is a term I've never really understood myself. But
one of the things that matters is how educated our elected leaders are.
I wonder. I don't know. Because I'm an economist, I kind of casually track whenever economists get elected and so on. And my casual empiricism suggests that maybe we're better off without economists running, becoming politicians. There's some I like, but there's quite a few I don't like. I've really never seen any work on that. It'd be interesting to do it, though.
So how does the presence of immigrants affect institutional quality? How, particularly if, as you said, immigrants tend to be somewhat less politically active than their neighbors, how does that have an effect?
Well, our work says that immigrants, at least on average for the typical country, have had positive effects on institutional quality. The reaction of the native-borns is primarily to shore up their institutions to accommodate immigrants. The immigrants themselves, again, probably are more interested in jobs and economic opportunity. And if you want jobs and economic opportunity, you want good institutions, because good institutions are what creates good opportunities. You don't want to go to a country that is corrupt to move to another country and make it more corrupt too, because people vote with their feet. They have an experience with corrupt regimes, and they know how bad it was. That's why they left. So all the push seems to be in favor of better institutions, not worse.
there are lots of people who worry that the fact that we seem to not have control over a lot of immigration that happens here, in other words, people who come here without legal documentation, is evidence that we don't have good quality leadership. We don't have, rule of law in this country. From an economics perspective, what's the story there?
You know, people use this word rule of law a lot. And to me, what rule of law means, it means impartial application of the law. It doesn't necessarily mean rigid, unthinking application of the law. You know, someone who drives 1 mile over the speed limit is, I think most of us don't think that's a gross violation of the law. And I think most of us don't want to live in a world where the police cite everyone who drives a mile an hour over the speed limit. So rule of law, though, means that people are unbiased. So it does mean if the cop lets you off with a speeding ticket, he's even-handed about how he does that. If he does it for one, he's going to do it for the next person. He doesn't discriminate against white drivers versus black drivers or what have you. So one of the problems, though, is that when laws are really unfair, people break them. I mean, imagine a 10-mile-an-hour speed limit on the Central Expressway. That is unfair. It's unrealistic. It's unreasonable. Everyone would drive a lot faster than 10 miles an hour. And if you were a police officer, what would you do? You can't pull over and literally stop everybody. So no matter how you do it as a police officer, you're going to be unfair in who you cite. Some people are going to get cited. Some people are not going to get cited. But the root cause is that the speed limit was too low. And I think we have the same problem with immigration. The speed limit is too low. The restrictions are too great. We're not letting enough immigrants in, and it's unfair. Again, it's just unfair in a lot of people's eyes. It's certainly unfair in the immigrants' eyes when they know that if I can get to America, I can increase my income 1,000%. That's perceived by people as being unfair. Just as a 10-mile-an-hour speed limit is perceived as being unfair, and they're going to break the law, and that's going to create a rule of law problem. So to me, all the issue of this discussion about the rule of law, it really invites, I think it should invite a more serious discussion about the law itself and whether the law itself is fair. You know, if you have a fair law, you don't have rule of law issues. You know, if you have a speed limit of 60 miles an hour on the Central, which of course very rarely can you actually do that. If you have a speed limit of 60, people think it's fair. And if you get caught going 70, 75, and you get a ticket, people go, oh, yeah, I was kind of breaking the rule. You know, if you had a more open immigration regime and some people still cheated, well, then I think we'd go, yeah, you cheated. You know, but right now the numbers are just too low. I mean, we're talking about, just off the top of my head, I mean, we're probably looking at an order of magnitude, like 10 times more people want to come to the United States, maybe 50 times more people want to come to the United States than we let in legally. That's a 10-mile-an-hour speed limit, and it's a recipe for all kinds of problems.
What do you make of the argument, and this may be asking you to go outside what you've studied, but people who say, well, if we adjust the law to allow legally many of the people who are here right now to have come in legally, then that will encourage people, you know, a far greater number of individuals to come and sort of break the law to a greater extent or abuse whatever policies allow them to get in and go around undetected.
Well, I don't think that's the case. I mean, again, I kind of have the speed limit metaphor in my head. Maybe I'm going to push that too far. But
so you're not going to drive 100 in a 30.
Exactly. You know, exactly. And if you get that speed limit set at 60 where it should be, some people are still going to cheat, but it won't be very many. If you set it at 10, a lot of people are going to cheat. I mean, we're going to have to. So I think it's about aligning the policy itself, which in this case is the number of immigrants we legally allow into the country, aligning that policy with what the immigrants themselves see as a reasonable, you know, a fair number, and also what Americans. I mean, there's quite a few Americans who are helping. I mean, these immigrants aren't coming to the United States and just sitting on their hands. They're coming and getting jobs from employers who are very happy to employ them. In fact, on Friday, we're going to listen to a businessman in Texas who's having trouble, you know, getting people to work. He thinks the immigration policy is unfair because he can't run his business effectively because he can't find workers.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak now with James in Dallas. Hi, James.
Hello. Thank you.
Sure.
Yes, for the guest, I have a question. When people coming from other countries, how do they select or qualify the people financial better, or is it random? Or I know political, because there's political strife, but could a person need to be better off?
Well, I think we've got your question, James, and I appreciate it. And it's I know it's a complicated answer, but maybe you can give us, Bob, the 50,000-foot view.
Sure. I mean, there's basically two ways to get to the United States. One is to be a highly educated person, get one of those H-1 type immigrant visas. These are your doctors and engineers who come from India, and stereotypically and so on. But the other way to get in is through a family connection and having a being married to an American or having a family sponsor. There are country quotas as well, so it's very complicated and very bureaucratic. And one thing I would love to see in terms of immigration reform would be a more sensible policy, a policy that doesn't treat Peruvians differently than we treat Costa Ricans or Malaysians, a more general sort of application process that treats the whole world's immigrant community as sort of equal, and one person I know actually says we should just auction them off. We should just have sign a number, 200,000 or 2 million immigrant visas, and then just have a sort of an eBay auction, and the top 200 million or 2 billion visitors get the bidders get the visas.
What are the origins of setting those rates by country?
As far as I know, they were set by the sort of ratio of immigrants. Mm-hmm. Back, 30 years ago or 40 years ago, I forget which. I'm not really a historian of immigration law. So they looked at the ratio of people who came to the United States in old times, and they sort of assigned quotas based on that. Now, if you're an Englishman and you want to visit the United States, immigrate to the United States, it's quite easy because there's a lot of English people in the United States, people of English origin, and there's a large quota. But, of course, there isn't much demand. I mean, a lot of English people do move to the United States, but there isn't that much demand because England's pretty nice. So ironically, there are unused quotas almost from countries like England.
We're speaking this hour with Robert Lawson, who holds the Jerome M. Fullenweider Endowed Centennial Chair in Economic Freedom at SMU's O'Neill Center for Global Markets and Freedom. On Friday the 26th, the center is sponsoring a conference called The Road to Freedom, Migration and the Search for a Better Life. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Robert Lawson, who holds the Jerome M. Fullenweider Endowed Centennial Chair in Economic Freedom at SMU's O'Neill Center for Global Markets and Freedom. The center is hosting a conference on Friday called The Road to Freedom, Migration and the Search for a Better Life. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. I want to shift gears here for just a minute because you've also written a lot about the impact of visa requirements on the money spent by people who don't plan to come and live here but want to come and stay here and travel around the country, do business perhaps. What is the purpose of an advanced visa, and why is acquiring one such a disincentive for people who might otherwise come to the U.S.?
Well, one exercise to do is to go to the U.S. State Department website and look at the process for obtaining a visa to travel to the United States. Suppose you're a Brazilian citizen and a middle-class Brazilian, and you want to go to Disney World or maybe go to the Grand Canyon or stop up in New York and do some shopping and take in a show. It is quite a process for Brazilians to get a visa, a simple entry visa for, a short stay, just a vacation. You have to get an appointment, get some fingerprint for fingerprints, and there's a set of forms there, and then you got to go to a U.S. consulate or embassy, and I don't know how many there are in Brazil, but Brazil is a vast country. This could involve several days of your life just to get the permission from the U.S. government to enter the United States just for a vacation. In comparison, if that same Brazilian family wants to go to Paris, which is a pretty nice place, I hear, and maybe go to Disney and in Euro Disney, there's nothing they need to do but buy a plane ticket, get on the plane, and land in Paris, and they're there. There's no visa requirement for Brazilians who want to visit France. So economists always say we should think at the margin. And thinking at the margin, if I was Brazilian, it looks a little bit easier to go to France. So
France gets those tourist dollars, and we miss out.
They do, and we've run the numbers. I've got a paper right now with a colleague, and we are estimating how much it America loses out in tourist travel because we have a very restrictive visa regime. It's one of the worst in the world. I think Australia's and the United States are sort of in a running battle for the worst most restrictive visa regimes. We just as a data point, we require visas of 80% of the countries in the world. So yeah, English people can come to the United States without a visa. They can just visit. There's something called a visa waiver program. A number of countries can come under that. But most people who live in this world can't visit the United States without going through this very elaborate process.
And my understanding is the visa waiver program applies. It feels almost random, the countries that qualify for it. Am I right about that?
Well, it's mostly European or high-income countries, you know, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, and things like that. But it does omit, I mean, you know, it doesn't include Brazil. And Brazil is a relatively high-end, or at least it has a lot of high-income people, people who would be potential visitors to the United States. It doesn't include China. Indonesia, I mean, you can list a lot of large countries that have large groups of people who are potential visitors. And the visa policies, we estimate fairly large effects. So just the main number that we have from the paper is that if you have a visa, if the U.S. has a visa against another country, we estimate a 70% reduction in travel from that country. The flip side of that is if you get rid of the visa, you would expect a tripling in travel from that country. These are big effects. If you imagined a world where we didn't require visas, which is never going to happen, I suppose. But if you imagine that world, we're estimating something on the order of 45 million annual visitors that we're losing out on to the United States. That's annually. The World Tourism Organization estimates that about each traveler to the United States spends about $2,000 on the ground. So multiply that by $2,000, you're looking at $90-100 billion. Every year that we're not getting into the American economy because we have these requirements that people obtain visas.
This would seem like something that the tourist industry at least would lobby very, very heavily to get or to eliminate, I should say.
There is building pressure, I think, around the world, not just in the United States because we're one of the worst, but by no means are we the only countries with bad visa policies. So there's growing concern. I think it's almost like 20 years ago when people were finally starting to talk about how we need to lower tariffs around the world. These are almost like tariffs on people. And slowly but surely, this UNWTO, this World Tourism Organization, is building a charge to try to get countries into some sort of multilateral agreement. Say, look, you don't require a visa on us. We won't require a visa on you. And that's essentially how we got trade barriers down over the last few generations. And that's the kind of thing I think we're going to see in visas.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Karen in Euless. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I have a very quick question.
Sure.
In regard, it sounds like you're already talking about it a bit. My question was, how hard is it in comparison to other countries? Is it for somebody to actually come into the country, to migrate to the country permanently? How are we on the spectrum of things? Are we the worst? Are we in the middle? How are we doing?
That's a really difficult question to answer. Visa policy, simple tourist visas that I was just talking about, are actually pretty easy to measure. The complexity of immigration policy, permanent immigration policies, are just really hard. It's really hard to compare all the apples and the oranges. Our policy that favors some countries over other countries, how would I compare that with, I don't know, say Indonesia's? In some sense, it's also kind of complicated by the fact that a lot of countries no one wants to go to. I mean, there aren't a lot of people who want to permanently emigrate to Afghanistan. So if you looked at the immigration numbers themselves, you would say, well, it would look like Afghanistan's very strict and they don't let immigrants in. But that's really just because no one wants to go there. Flip side of that is we do let a lot of immigrants in the United States. And it looks like we're quite open. But in context of the vast potentially millions of more people who would like to come, we are actually pretty restrictive. Honestly, though, I wish we had a really good quantitative measure of how restrictive a country is, and we could compare countries on that dimension. But we don't really have a good measure of that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Nicole in Dallas. Hi, Nicole.
Hi. I have less of a question, more of a requiring a clarification. You had mentioned earlier, Mr. Lawson, about how much easier it was for British people to gain immigration status in the United States. As an immigrant, I can tell you it isn't any easier than it is for some of other nationalities. Quite simply, even being married to an American citizen, an ex-Vietnam vet, someone who is financially independent and still I had difficulties. And when I say difficulties, it took 18 months before they would acknowledge that I was gave me legal status and gave me a green card. Many years afterwards did I apply for citizenship.
Well, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely right. I didn't want to leave the impression that it's an easy process, even if you come from a country like England. It's absolutely nightmarish. I mean, I've had colleagues, being a professor, we have a lot of colleagues who come from other countries and they've had to obtain green cards. It is a multi-year process requiring, I've heard estimates of $20,000 in legal fees in the H-1 market. So it's definitely a process and it's not easy. I think it's more that it's easier for an English person because the quota system has more spots. If you're a Mexican and want to legally immigrate to the United States, it's all but impossible, frankly, because, it's not impossible, of course, but it's just that there's so many more people who want to come relative to the number of spots available that it's much more of a lottery with respect to, say, countries like Mexico.
If you are a Mexican immigrant and you show up with a college degree in hand, does that clear any pathways?
I think you still can go under the H-1 thing. The H-1 thing is not driven by national origin. So, indeed, if you are a Mexican professor, doctor, engineer, and you have an employer willing to sponsor you through that process, I think it's the same process as everyone else.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Joshua on the line in Arlington. Hi, Joshua.
Hello. I understand your guest to be promoting sort of a loosening of migration restrictions, but for maintaining migration controls. And, of course, there's nothing new about migration controls in the United States in the sense that they've been around for a long time. Since, one could argue, the 19th century, the Fugitive Slave Act was a kind of migration control, the Black Laws that prevented people from escaping slavery. With the migration control, also the Chinese Exclusion Act in the early 20th century. So I wonder if, does your guest not see similarities between promoting migration controls now and the promotion of migration controls in the past in the United States?
I surely do. In fact, as I mentioned earlier, there is nothing really new about this. The Chinese Exclusion Act was the first restriction on immigration into the United States. I wasn't really thinking of the Fugitive Trade Act, but that's a good example of domestic migration control. I mean, one of the things that I think Americans take for granted and we should be proud of is the fact that you can travel from one state to the other and you barely even notice the sign as you go from one state to the next. We have no tariffs on goods or service, but we also have no border checks. And you can get in your car here in Dallas and drive literally days without a border control. That is a tremendous benefit to Americans. It allows us much easier access to engage in trade, visit friends and family. And we have these arbitrary lines on the map that have been drawn. I sometimes call them lines on maps drawn by dead white people because frequently it's really how these lines got drawn. And they were drawn for haphazard reasons in the past. And, a poor person who was born in Matamoros finds it much more difficult to travel to see their cousin across the river in Brownsville, Texas, than I would to visit my family in Ohio, which is, 1,000 miles away. It's kind of bizarre that a 10-mile trip, to visit your cousin is a bureaucratic nightmare, whereas, 1,000 miles to visit my family is no problem at all.
We have an email here from Russ who says, Brazil requires U.S. citizens to have a visa to visit. So does China. How much of this is tit for tat?
There is evidence of tit for tat. There is evidence of what we call reciprocity. Having said that, the U.S. is a terrible example to use here. As I mentioned, the United States requires visas of 80% of the countries in the world. In contrast, something like 65%, I could look up the number, but it's around 65% of the rest of the world doesn't require a visa of Americans. So the United States government is very restrictive on foreign visitors to the United States. Meanwhile, the rest of the world is quite happy to take Americans, and obviously American dollars, I presume, with that. So we're if we were applying reciprocity to the U.S. policy, it would require a massive reduction in our visa requirements.
Is there something about an economic approach to immigration that sort of eliminates the struggle that we seem to have in this country with racism or xenophobia? In other words, an economist doesn't care if a brown hand or a white hand or a black hand spends a dollar as long as it spends a dollar.
Chris, I love you for asking that question. I think one of the things that I'm most proud about being an economist and being in the economics profession is what I think I sometimes might call the methodological cosmopolitanism. That is, the method, the way in which we approach problems is to look at the well-being of people, and everybody counts. Everybody counts equally, too. If you're a supplier or a rich person, you count just as much as a poor person in terms of your welfare. We don't play favorites inside of economics. And it also applies to nationalities. There's sort of a built-in cosmopolitanism to the way in which economists look at problems. And I think it pushes us in the direction of, well, it pushes us in the direction, for example, freer trade when we're talking about goods. It also pushes us in the direction of more open immigration. I'm not necessarily saying open borders, although some people are in favor of that. But it certainly pushes you, nudges you in that direction, because the rules of the game inside of economics don't allow you to play favorites with suppliers or buyers or rich people or poor people or Mexicans or Americans.
Tell us a little bit in the minute or so we have left about what else is happening at the conference on Friday.
Sure. The conference is a sort of a mini conference. It runs from 8 o'clock in the morning on SMU's campus till about 1:30 in the afternoon. In the morning, we've got a few scholars that are coming in, a young kid. He's a young scholar from UTEP. He's tenured now. He's not a kid. One of my former professors from Ohio University will be there. He'll be talking about that auction idea for visas. Alex Navrasta will come in from the Cato Institute. He's involved deeply in the political debate in Washington, the policy wonk debate about immigration reform and things like that. And I also have a really fascinating, hopefully fascinating, talk from Carolyn Bertrell, who's an anthropologist at SMU.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Robert Lawson holds the Jerome M. Fullenwider Endowed Centennial Chair in Economic Freedom at SMU's O'Neill Center for Global Markets and Freedom. That conference is Friday, September 26th. It's called The Road to Freedom, Migration, and the Search for a Better Life. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had help on the phones today from Christina Alsh, and Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org, and you can find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink. Once again, I am Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.